This is the news and talk of Nevada. Now, Nevada Outlook, a discussion of Northern Nevada issues on News Talk 780 KOH.
Good morning. I'm Daniela Cennino, and this is Nevada Outlook. Today, we're talking with Aaron Meyer from the Nevada Department of Wildlife about cold water shock and how to stay safe when you're out on Lake Tahoe this summer. Cold water shock. It's no joke, right?
It really isn't. I looked at the temperatures for the next few days, and it's supposed to be 80 plus up in Tahoe, and the water looks like it's going to be about 55 to 56.
So what does that mean when it comes to cold water shock? Explain that process.
Yeah, often what happens is, I mean, sometimes it's even a person jumping off the boat all by themselves, but you're on a boat or you're on your paddleboard and it's toasty outside and you think, I'm just going to jump off into the water to cool off. But you don't realize that water, as pretty as it is extremely cold. And that shock of going from 80 degrees to 50 degrees is so drastic that what often happens is while the person's underwater, their first instinct is to gasp. And you take a big gasp of water, and you just started the process of drowning.
We're talking with Aaron Meyer with the Nevada Department of Wildlife about cold water shock and general overall water safety when it comes to having fun in the summer sun. So what's that process? We talked about that in the past. You have, like, limited amount of time once that happens.
Yeah, you really do. We refer to it as the 1-10-1 rule. If you hit the water and you don't do that gasp underwater, but you're still, you know, freaking out because your body's reacting to something much colder than it thought it was going to get, you have a minute to get your breathing under control. Because what happens a lot of times is the person will hyperventilate while they're in the water because they're freaking out. Their body's reacting to how cold the water is, and they overreact or they can't calm down, and they hyperventilate and pass out and drown. Let's assume you fell off the boat and you were the only person on it, or you fell off your paddleboard or whatever it was, and that is now left. So you have 10 minutes to figure out what you're going to do to self-rescue, because during between 5 and 10 minutes, your body is going to start shutting down your legs and your arms. It's going to start protecting its vital organs, so it's going to start pulling back. What it thinks it's doing is saving you, and it's really putting you in danger, because you'll realize very quickly that you no longer have use of your arms and legs. So swimming to the shore is out of the question. You have 10 minutes to either, let's assume your boat capsized or whatnot. You have about 10 minutes to get yourself on there and, you know, start yelling for help or whatever it is. You don't have a lot of time. And what happens is a lot of people look at the shore. It's 100 yards offshore or even 75, 80 yards offshore. You don't have that kind of time. You're not going to be able to swim to the shore. You have to self-rescue. Obviously, only real answer to fighting cold water shock is wearing a life jacket, because if you fall off the boat and it's cold, like, your body will still react to how cold the water is, but the life jacket's keeping you above the water, and then you won't. The drastic need to get on top of the boat or to find something to float on isn't quite as drastic because you have a life jacket. Like, the life jacket is going to put you in a position where you can call for help now, and you don't have to figure out what to do during that 10 minutes, you know, where your body's going to start shutting down.
It buys you some time at that point, right?
It does. The life jacket, as is always the case, the life jacket is your answer to almost every problem you're going to have out on that water. And especially with cold water shock, that life jacket will definitely save your life.
Aaron Meyer with the Nevada Department of Wildlife. What other steps can we take to be safe on the water? I know there's some rules when it comes to kids under, is it 13 or 12 when it comes to being 12. On bodies of water in Nevada?
It's funny because the law is kind of confusing because, yes, it's under 13. If 13 and above, there has to be enough jackets for everybody on the boat, but 12 and under, they have to be wearing it if the boat's out on the water.
And what if they're just swimming on the shoreline? I know that I took a ride with the search and rescue team a couple years ago, and one of your guys was talking to a 12-year-old out on a paddle boat without a life jacket. Once he gets past the shoreline, he's pretty much required, if you're 12 and under, to have that on, right?
I have to be honest. I spoke with a game warden on that very topic, and I said, you know, how far offshore does someone 12 and under need to be to have that jacket on? And he said 2 inches. He said, once you're on that kayak or paddleboard or boat and you're on the water, you legally have to have that life jacket on. So I know it sounds silly, but, you know, if you're 2 inches offshore, very soon you're going to be 12 feet offshore. So there's no specific, and now you need to wear your life jacket. you just need to wear your life jacket.
Do you relay that story that you and I chatted about the guy that got the ticket?
Oh, I was on patrol with some of our game wardens, you know, just to get some pictures, and a rather large individual on a paddleboard was only, I would say, 15, 20 feet offshore, but he had no life jacket on his paddleboard, and he got a citation. Because that's the flaw. You have to have, because we just talked about cold water shock. 15, 20 feet offshore, it's still 55 degrees. The law, there is no set amount of distance from the shore where the law kicks in. If the law says you have to have a life jacket on your kayak or on your paddleboard, you have to have it on the board. It's not, oh, I'm just going to be, you know, 20 feet offshore.
Yeah, let's
People
be real
get
clear.
In 20 feet all the time.
Let's be real clear for our listeners. That means that an adult 13 and older, or a teen or an adult 13 or older, has to have the life jacket on board the vessel. They don't necessarily have to be wearing it, but there has to be one for that individual on the vessel. But when we're talking about a 12-year-old or, you know, brothers and sisters out 10, 11, or whatever the case may be, those kids need to have those jackets on all the time, regardless.
Correct. And there's the thing that we're always talking about is yes, a child 12 and under, there is no time when they can't have a life jacket or when they're allowed to not have a life jacket on. You have to have a life jacket on the kids 12 and under. If a game warden or anyone else pulls up to your boat and their kids aren't wearing their life jacket because they were whining or complaining or it was too hot, you're going to get a ticket, because we understand that kids whine about pretty much everything, but the goal here is to keep them in the safest place possible, and that's in a life jacket if they're on the water. Anyone 13 and over, you have to have a life jacket on that kayak, on that paddleboard, on that boat for everybody there. What we always say, and this is where, you know, people raise their eyebrows at me, is I'd prefer if you all wore your life jackets all the time when you were on the water. I mean, I understand the law says it only has to be on the boat, but if there's an accident, you're not going to have time to go searching through your cabinet for the life jacket. If your boat hits a rock and people get ejected, they're not going to be wearing their life jacket. So you will have been legally, you know, following the law, but now you just put people in danger because they're not wearing a life jacket during a collision, and now they're in the water, you know, struggling. With the life jacket's there for a reason. It's for if you accidentally get tossed into the water or get hurt, the life jacket's going to keep you floating. If it's in a cabinet, it can't do that.
Aaron Meyer with the Nevada Department of Wildlife. And this is a great time right now. People are getting ready to get on their boats for the first time, or maybe they already have. Check that equipment and make sure everybody's got a life jacket. And if it looks kind of funky, it's not too much to replace them, right?
No, they're not. They're not expensive. And that's exactly right. Is what often happens. Well, not often, but happens is people, you know, they buy those jackets when they got the boat, and then 7-8 years later, it's the same old jacket stuffed into a cabinet, and then maybe it's become worn or a little bit. But if you have any questions, just go replace that jacket, because you don't want to wind up in the water, and that's when you find out that the jacket's faulty.
Where can people learn more about safe boating and recreating out on our lakes and rivers safely with their families?
We have lots of great information on our website at ndow.org. There's a whole sections for boating safety, but there's also whole sections about things you can do out there with the boat. All things boating is on our website, so definitely go to ndow.org if you have any questions. And my email's on there, too, so if you have a specific question, shoot it to me, and I'll ask our game wardens and make sure I get you the right answer, because as you and I have talked about before, I'm not trying to tell you not to go out there boating. I think it's one of the greatest things you can do, and Tahoe is one of the best places to do it in the world. So by all means, if you have if you have a kayak or a paddleboard or a boat or friends who do, and you have a chance to get out there, get out there. Just do it safely so that everybody comes home and we just have a good time.
Aaron Meyer with the Nevada Department of Wildlife, thanks so much for the conversation today.
Thank you.
I'm Daniela Cennino, and this is Nevada Outlook.
The news and talk of Nevada. This is Nevada Outlook on News Talk 780 KOH.
This is Nevada Outlook. Today we're talking with the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center, specifically Dr. Jeff Schlatto, with the research center who's using an aerosol deposition collector on Lake Tahoe. It's the latest step the center's using to track Lake Tahoe water clarity. And they're looking at the effects of the Tamarack Fire and other fires in Northern California and Northern Nevada on the lake. I sat down with him this week to get more details on this new project that they're working on. You guys have a monitoring system that you've installed on the mid-lake buoys. This is a real interesting thing that's monitoring some of the smoke that's coming in from the Tamarack fire. Can you tell me a little bit about this project?
Well, yeah, I mean, we've had collectors out on buoys for many years, but we've always just focused on the nutrients that come in from the air, whether it's during a fire or between fires. But what we've recently installed are special samplers for collecting particles, very fine particles from the smoke and the ash that that can come into the lake during fires, or even, as again, as I said before, between fires. There's a lot of material just falls out of the sky on a day-to-day basis.
So you're not like the EPA that tests the air quality.
Well, no, that's recorded by the California Air Resources Board. They have stations at South Lake Tahoe and in Tahoe City. So they're measuring the air quality index. We're actually measuring the physical particles and then taking them to the lab and measuring their exact size and calculating their impact on clarity.
How long have you guys been working with this new device?
Well, it's only been out there for 2 weeks. So, we can't say what the impact is yet. But we are fortunate we got it out pretty much before the Tamarack fire started. And we'll be looking, through the Tamarack fire and through, literally continuing throughout the year from now going forward.
Research shows that smoke lowers sunlight and UV radiation levels, which impacts the food web of the lake. Can you explain that to us and how in a real succinct way so we kind of understand what that means?
Yeah, no, I get it. So Lake Tahoe has has high levels of UV radiation, and because of that, a lot of the small animals that live in the water tend to stay very deep. What we found over previous fires is that when the smoke is clouding the air, the UV is reduced, and these zooplankton move a lot higher, a lot closer to the surface, and then they start feeding on different algae closer to the water surface. Well, that results in, say, more removal of algae in those parts of the lake where algae are affecting lake clarity. So, what it's saying is that things like smoke, if we start to have persistent periods of smoke for, say, months every summer going forward, then the whole internal workings, the biological workings of the lake will start to shift. And that 250 AQI, that lasted just for a few hours, then the winds changed, and we're back to an air quality index of 15 or 16. So, it's almost impossible to predict what it will be, and then next week a new fire may start somewhere else. So, it's something we have no control over.
Talk to us about zooplankton.
Zooplankton are critical parts of the food web. They basically eat the microscopic phytoplankton, the tiny floating plants. And so if you didn't have the zooplankton there, the lake would be literally overrun with these microscopic plants that would change the color of the lake, it would change the clarity. So you need the zooplankton there to keep the phytoplankton in check. If we didn't have zooplankton, we would lose a critical part of the food web. But with the smoke, they just change their position in their depth in the lake. And so the smoke actually seems to be helping the zooplankton as they remove algae closer to the surface of the lake and possibly increase the clarity. Right now, they're removing the phytoplankton deep in the lake where it doesn't affect clarity. Once the UV is reduced and they move higher up, then they can be more effective. So you could say they're on our side. But the smoke is also adding nutrients to the lake. So the smoke is not on our side in other ways. So the bottom line is climate change and wildfires are affecting lakes all over the West in ways that we're just really starting to explore now.
We're talking with Jeffrey Schladow. He's a professor at the Tahoe Environmental Research Center in Incline Village. They study lake clarity and other things going on up at Lake Tahoe. So what you're saying is in some cases, fires are beneficial in an odd way to the zooplankton.
Yeah, but there are other factors to do with wildfires that are negative. So what the net effect will be on balance, we've yet to find out. But that's why we're so intensively looking at it.
What do you guys call this measuring device that you're using at the lake right now?
It's just an aerosol deposition collector.
So you have two methods, one to collect nutrients and one to collect particles.
Nutrients is one system, and then very fine particles is a separate system we've now installed. Well, yeah, basically it's that's a holder for a bucket. So that's what we sit the bucket in. We have distilled water in that bucket, and it's out there for 10 days, and then we bring it into the lab, and it has to be handled in a way that it's not contaminated in any way, and we bring it back. And for that particular one, that's the one we collect the nutrient samples in. That bucket is made of plastic, and the plastic sheds little particles, so we can't use that for particles. So the new one we have is a specially designed stainless steel system. But again, the greatest amount of work is cleaning it to make sure there are no particles in there when it's deployed. And that way we can, after 10 days, we can find out how many particles have come in.
So it's kind of like a Roomba vacuum for the lake, so to speak.
Except it doesn't suck like a Roomba. It just sits there. It's sitting above the lake, and it's like it's a collector full of water. So it's like a mini lake with ultra clean water, and particles fall into it. It's a whole lot less sophisticated than you're imagining. Yeah, we've just collected the first samples. We haven't looked at that yet. So maybe that's something we can do. Let's say that may be possible to do an analysis as to how much of it is plastic, how much of it is burnt trees, how much of it is just soil particles. All that's possible. But also, these fires generate winds as well that wafts things into the air. And so what comes in when structures burn? Our homes are made of some pretty weird stuff these days.
Thanks, Dr. Schlatto, and we'll send everybody over to the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center in Incline Village to see up close what you guys are doing there when it comes to research on the lake. If you'd like to go, it's at 291 Country Club Drive in Incline Village, and it's open Tuesday through Friday from 1 till 5 p.m. You can get more details on the center at tahoe.ucdavis.edu. I'm Daniela Cennino, and this is Nevada Outlook.
On air, online, on demand. News Talk 780 KOH.